political polling, and the 2020 election. It's hard to ignore the polls during an election year. If you feel strongly about politics, chances are you can cite poll numbers off the top of your head. Who's ahead? Who's behind? How the numbers have shifted? But how are those polls conducted? And how do pollsters make sure they get the right balance of real people who reflect the voting public accurately? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the current state of political polling. We'll hear from those who conduct polls and those who study how polls are put together. Are you nervous when you read the results of the latest poll? Do you ignore the polls altogether? Have you been called or texted by an organization doing polling? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tis the season for campaign yard signs, cold calls, and polls. Lots and lots of polls. Today we'll learn how pollsters do the work they do, how the results of the 2016 election affected how polling is done, and how the silence of polling continues to evolve. This show is part of Maine Public's Your Vote 2020 special election coverage. My guest today, Daniel Shea, who is chair and professor in the Department of Government at Colby College. Andrew Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, and Scott Keeter, a senior survey advisor with the Pew Research Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been asked to participate in a poll? Have you been following the polls? Is there one in particular that you pay attention to? You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Dan, in the last few weeks, I've been doing a lot more driving than I had been for a long time, and I'm seeing a lot of yard signs pop up. When you see these yard signs popping up, what do you, as somebody who's a political science professor and a polling expert, think?
Well, first, Jennifer, thanks for having the program. It's a great topic. Yeah, everybody's getting a lot of calls. We're doing a lot of calls. You know, I think we're getting so many polls because we're in this really uncertain period. It's uncertain across the nation, but also in Maine. So when we lack information, we often turn to whatever we can to try to understand what's happening in our world. And one way we all do that is we look around in our neighborhoods and we see those yard signs that you're talking about. So one sort of way we collect information about what other people are thinking is through what's happening in our neighborhoods. But social scientists and campaigns and pollsters have figured out that we can do a deeper dive into opinions and attitudes by running randomized surveys. So what you might see is a whole bunch of posters might be indicative of strong support for the president, but they might not be. So polls add this additional layer, and I would argue a much more sophisticated, in-depth layer of information.
It's interesting you say sophisticated, in-depth information. Scott, after the 2016 election, a lot of people were critical of the polls.
Yes, indeed, and rightly so. I think people took away from the corpus of all the polling that went on in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in. There are a lot of reasons for that, partly because the national polling consistently showed her ahead, and that polling turned out to be correct. The average of all the national polls was about a 3-point lead for her. She actually carried the popular vote by 2 percentage points, so a historically pretty accurate performance by the national polls. But where the polls went wrong was in some of the key states that flipped, especially the so-called blue wall of the Midwest that Democrats had consistently won over the last few decades. And there, a few polls indicated that she was going to win, and she didn't win those states. So there definitely was a black eye for polling. And the good news, though, is that we understand pretty well what happened. both to specific polls and sort of more generally in the election, the sort of dynamics of an election in which there were two very unpopular candidates and a lot of people who had trouble figuring out who they were going to vote for. Ultimately, many of them, most of them perhaps, broke to Donald Trump, and I think that contributed to some of the problems as well. So we're not fighting the 2016 war in 2020. There may be other issues that get in our way, but I think polling seriously addressed pollsters seriously addressed the issues that we confronted in 2016 and are trying to do better this time. And we'll see how it works out, but I have a lot of faith in my colleagues in the field.
All right, trying to do better. Andy Smith, you, Dan, and Scott all conduct polls. Andy, how are you doing things differently this time around?
I'll answer that, but I'd like to say one more thing to Scott's point. The motivations that survey researchers, particularly academic survey researchers, have when they're looking at when they do election polling is really to understand how well the methods that they use actually can work in a real-world environment where we have an actual prediction of something, where you can see what human behavior is likely to be. So when you see something like a presidential job approval rating, well, there's nothing that you can really benchmark that against other than other polls. But with an election, you have an actual outcome. And we use that to try to modify or improve the methods that we use. So that's our incentives. But on the media's part, the incentives really are still to sell advertising. George Gallup got into this business, back in the 1930s, promising that you'd sell more ads and you'd sell more newspapers if you ran the Gallup poll. And that's still true today. And that, I think, is one of the problems that we've got is that with the media today, we have fewer people that have a real expertise in survey research. And pretty much now, a poll is a poll is a poll. And there's no real distinction between what we would say are high quality or gold standard polling versus traditional polling. And those things have changed over time. And that's what we're doing here at UNH is that we have been changing our methodology over time in large part because there's now, I think, a growing body of evidence that there's not that the what we used to think of as gold standard random digit dialing surveys really aren't that much better predictors of outcomes than our other methodologies of conducting survey research. And the costs of doing those random digit dialing surveys have increased dramatically. Our costs have increased more than 100% over the last 4 years. So we've been experimenting with probability-based web samples, web surveys, where we have a panel of about 6,000 to 7,000 people here in New Hampshire that we can that have been selected at random, and we can survey them over the telephone, or excuse me, over a web survey, which is much less expensive, but we still retain that ability to use the central limit theorem and some of the probability theory that has enabled survey researchers since the 1940s to be pretty accurate in how they predict elections.
Mm. Dan Shea, the gold standard surveys, I'm sure that the standards are very high for all three of you. I want to sort of back up a little bit and talk a little bit about how complicated a poll is, even if it seems simple, even if there are just a few questions. You're thinking about what questions to ask, how to ask them, in what order to ask them, who to ask them to, how to weigh the demographics of who you ask. Throw some more in there. Explain to me sort of the whole rubber band ball that goes into the most simple poll.
Well, I am glad that this is a four-hour show, so we can start. we can start to go through some of these issues. But here's at the most sort of treetop level. What makes a poll accurate are really, I think, two things. The first is randomness. That is, everyone in your population should have the equal likelihood of being selected, right? So, and that's really difficult because different demographic groups are more likely to pick up the phone or do a survey online and so forth. So that issue itself of making sure that you're grabbing a random selection of the population is really important. And then on top of that, are your measures valid? Do they reflect, do they give you what you think they're going to give you? So this idea of randomness and valid answers, those are really at the heart of good polling, and those two issues themselves can just take a great deal of time to get right. So what happens, for example, and I'll let the others chime in here, but what happens on the randomness issue is you pay very, very close attention to key demographic issues as you're conducting a poll. You're making sure that there's a balance by geography, by gender, by age, by income and education and so forth. And there's a process where you can tweak your calling or online research to better reflect those demographic groups. And in the end, there's still another layer, which is called the weighing process. And that is where different respondents will get a little extra boost or a little less of a boost in their responses based upon the demographic group you're looking at. So there are a lot of pieces that are part of this. And I will say, Pew Scott has been a leader, really, in exploring all these difficult issues of polling.
Scott, tell me how you look at polls as they're coming out. I suspect you see them all. You understand them very intimately. What are sort of the first glance measures that would help the rest of us determine whether or not a poll is to be believed?
Well, it's a very difficult question today because, as both of my colleagues have mentioned, there is a lot of change going on in the survey field. Andy mentioned the explosive growth of the cost of phone surveys. You know, that was a major contributor to our own decision to move from telephone surveys as the sort of principal method that we use to a panel recruited through random sampling that we then go back to month after month. But when I look at the field, there are a lot of actors out there, as I think Dan has pointed out, that you know, there's a lot of new people in the field, and it is very difficult to figure out who to trust and who not to trust. So the first thing that I look for is transparency. Does a poll that I don't know already and recognize as being done by methods that are dependable and by people whose expertise I respect and trust, is the poll that I'm trying to evaluate, is it explained in sufficient detail that I can see, have they adequately done the things that Dan was just talking about? Have they drawn a random sample? If it's not a random sample, if it's an opt-in sample of some kind, have they made an appropriate effort to adjust the demographics to make sure that it is representative of the population that they're trying to cover? And so, you know, if a poll is not transparent, if they don't tell you, for example, what are the exact questions, the wording of the exact questions and the sequence in which they're asked, then I really don't look any further at the poll because I don't think it's worthy of our trust. And that's a pretty easy one. Now, if you want to look for a more positive approach to who can you trust, I won't give you a kind of white list, as they say in the software world. But what I will say is that major news organizations have a lot of skin in the game. They have a tremendous amount of their reputational capital on the line in polling and elections, and the vast majority of them are doing a very good job. Many of them partner with academic pollsters like Dan and Andy. And I also, having once been an academic pollster, I tend to trust them because they have the expertise, they have a reputation to preserve. And so I think if you don't want to get into the weeds of how exactly the polls are done, you can still do pretty well by looking at who it is that's doing the poll.
Mm. Andy, let's talk about that, though. You know, these national polls that say, for example, I've seen one recently that says that Joe Biden is 7 points ahead of Donald Trump make me think, well, does that even matter? We've seen elections, more than one election, in which the person who wins the popular vote does not win the presidency. So why are there even polls showing what the general consensus is right now when they really don't have much bearing necessarily on who's going to win the election?
Well, that is an excellent point. We don't have a presidential election. We have 51 presidential elections. And all of the environments in each of those states are different. The campaigns are run differently in all of those states. As Scott mentioned about Hillary Clinton winning by about 2 percentage points in 2000, she won really big in California, but frankly, that didn't matter because she was going to win California anyway. The national polling is not indicative of necessarily who is going to win the election overall in the Electoral College, but it gives us a pretty good idea of the overall trends of what this election looks like compared to past elections. And I think that's especially true in an election when you have an incumbent president. As most presidential elections, when there is an incumbent, they're really just referenda on the incumbent. Is it basically thumbs up or thumbs down on what's now, after 4 years, a well-known incumbent? That doesn't mean that because Biden is up that Trump is necessarily going to lose, but it gives us a better sense of nationwide what the dynamics and trends are. The other things that I think that national polling do that touches on your very first question about yard signs is it basically sets the mood for the media, which sets the mood for the electorate as to which candidate is the popular candidate and which candidate is the unpopular candidate. There's a German public opinion researcher named Elisabeth Noelle Neumann who talked about this as the spiral of silence. That if you think your candidate is not very popular, you're less likely to put a yard sign out. You're less likely to have a bumper sticker or talk about that candidate at a cocktail party. And we get this sense then that a candidate is not doing well. In that sense, and this was, I think, true in 2016, Trump was certainly the less popular candidate in the eyes of the media. A lot of post-election research pointed to that. But he ended up winning. There may be some of that going on this time, so I'm a little bit hesitant still, because Trump is kind of a new and different phenomenon in American politics, to say that the national polls are necessarily going to be indicative of what the outcome is going to be.
Well, we are talking about polling on Maine Calling. We'd love to have your question for the experts. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine. AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/Maine Votes. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
With deaths from COVID-19 mounting, Dr. Atul Gawande says it's high time the U.S. deploys a national testing strategy.
This is as big as any casualty situation we've ever had. There is no reason we could not be deploying the dedicated effort to make this work.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, solving the coronavirus test mess this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. You may have heard Toby LaBoudelier taking us down memory lane this past Friday. Toby brought not just the music, but a bit of history around the early days of what we know today as the Maine Public Radio Network. He was here when it all began. It was 50 years ago today, September 14, 1970, that WMEH 90.9 FM Bangor went on the air for the first time, broadcasting out of Alumni Hall at the University of Maine in Orono. Radio stations in Portland, WMEA FM 90.1, and Presque Isle, WMEM FM 106.1, would follow within the next 10 years, in 1974 and 1978 respectively, as MPBN, the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, started taking shape. Public radio in Maine has come a long way in the past 50 years. Thanks for doing your part to help make this service what it is today.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how pollsters do the work they do. My guest, Andrew Smith, who is director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Scott Keeter, senior survey advisor with the Pew Research Center. And Daniel Shea, professor and chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post on today's Facebook post, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to the questions and calls, Scott, I want to ask you about a phrase I learned recently, which is the shy voter. How prevalent do you think this is, that somebody is embarrassed to say to someone on the phone who they will be voting for, but in reality is going to vote for that person in the voting booth?
The shy voter phenomenon has a long history. It, at least in sort of modern polling, dates all the way back to the 1980s. And its origins were in a gubernatorial election in California, where the California Democratic mayor, who was African-American, Tom Bradley, was leading in the polls and ended up losing the election. And so there was coined a thing called the Bradley effect, which was to indicate that people polled about an election that featured an African-American and a white candidate might not tell the truth about who they were supporting, or they'd say they were undecided when they weren't undecided. And we saw some evidence of that in 1989 in the gubernatorial election in Virginia that was won by the African-American candidate Douglas Wilder, but by a much narrower margin than his polls had indicated. And I actually polled in that race and was sort of a victim of that phenomenon. So all of us in the polling world who were working through the aughts were really worried about this, especially, you know, as more and more African-American candidates were running. But it seemed like the phenomenon completely vanished. And the polling in the 2008 presidential election, where Barack Obama was the Democratic candidate, was remarkably accurate. No sign whatsoever that the polls were underestimating him. Now, fast forward 8 years to the 2016 election, and one of the explanations that people have clung to for the failure of the polls in some places was the fact that Trump seemed to outperform his polls, and that maybe it was because people were embarrassed to admit it. There's really no systematic evidence that this is true. The professional organization that I belong to, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, had a commission that looked at the polls in the aftermath of the election. They looked at a lot of different ways of teasing this out. They did not find any compelling evidence that it was true. And I think it also raises an interesting question. Why is it that some elites might think that people who support people who support an African American candidate on the one hand, or Donald Trump in this case, would be embarrassed to admit it, or if they did, why would they be embarrassed to admit it, or why would they overstate support for an African American candidate? So I'm a skeptic. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but I think that relative to the other things that we have to make sure we get right to accurately predict an election, this is not a big one.
All right. Well, we're going to go to Frederick, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer and guests. Boy, this is a real treat for political junkies like me. Thank you for the show. I've been looking at a couple of polling outfits. One is Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia, and the other, of course, is Nate Silver from the New York Times, right? Now, they compare their polling this year to the 2016 election to set trends to see where the electorate may be moving. But my question for the panelists is, now, isn't 2018 much more indicative of a barometer, of a baseline, where we saw a dramatically different turnout in the election in the South and then even Middle America in places like Arizona. And I know Kansas had picked up a Democratic governor and a progressive congresswoman, and we all thought that would never happen in Kansas. So talk to us about why polling organizations are comparing 2016 rather than what I think is a much more accurate barometer, and that is 2018.
I know all of you could answer this. I'll turn to you, Andy. Go.
First of all, Larry Sabato, really good political scientist, but he's not a pollster, and neither is Nate Silver. They use other people's polls and basically combine those. So I would say that they are polling compilers. But to that point, I think that actually the 2018 election is more of the outlier. The dynamics in midterm elections are really unusual and very different than the dynamics in presidential elections. In midterm elections, the president's party almost always loses seats, certainly in the House of Representatives, but also in state houses. We saw this in 2014 and 2010 when Barack Obama was president. Republicans made big gains. We saw it in 2006 when George W. Bush was president. And Democrats made big gains. So I would be, if I were going to compare things, I would go back to the last presidential election, not saying that it's going to be necessarily predictive because electorates change. People move in and out of states. They are born, they turn 18 and then they die. So the electorates are never the same. But I would still look at the presidential election of 2016 rather than the 2018 midterm.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
I'll add to that real quickly, Jennifer. The snag in 2016, and I think your caller, Fred, I think he hit it right on the head. And it's not that we want to talk to registered voters or citizens. The snag is pollsters have to get their arms around actually who is going to turn out. It's all about surveying voters, not just registered voters, but people that will turn out. And what happened in those in the blue wall was that the pollsters missed a lot of voters that turned out in higher numbers than they expected. It was essentially white men without college degrees turned out in historic numbers. So the struggle now is to try to create a model that can predict not just preferences but voters. And that's tricky, right, because it shifts from year to year, but that's why we're seeing a comparison with 16. So 18 was a good year for Democrats, but I think Andy's absolutely right. It was an aberration. Back to 16 where we can, but pay very close attention in your survey work to try to pin down those who will actually come out.
Two similar emails here. I'm going to read both of them. The first from Anne. The person calling tells me who they work for, but they do not tell me who hired the company to do the poll. I may be helping the group I am against. In polls, people's opinions are the product. I am tired of being the product. I'm not on Facebook either. There is simply too much money spent on political campaigns. I don't want to feed that beast. And then from Brian, I have been receiving multiple text messages asking me to participate in a poll. The messages never identify themselves, and therefore I never respond. I'm thinking they're political scams. I'm happy to respond if I only knew who they are. Dan, when you do a poll, how do you identify yourself? And what would you say to Ann and Brian, who are skeptical?
Yeah, you should be skeptical. There are a lot. Yes, it's important. Back to Scott's point earlier about transparency. That's a very, very important part of the process, and it's what good academic firms do. We, for example, and hey, quick shout out for my colleagues, Carrie Levan and Nick Jacobs here at Colby, who are working on this with us. We publish all of our information, the instrument, the methodology, the results, and a massive cross-tabulation. So part of that transparency should be a disclosure of who's making the call. A lot of what you're getting in these texts and so forth are actually scams, and they're probably what are called push polls. What maybe my guest, my colleagues can say a little bit about what push polls are.
Scott, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean the basic definition of a push poll is that it isn't a poll; it's actually a messaging tool. Campaigns may use them and disguise them as polls, say, I'm interested in your opinion, and you get on there, and then they start asking you questions. But what they're doing is they're feeding you
highly negative information about one of the candidates, and they make a lot of these, far more than you would need for a traditional poll. And the idea is to try to influence opinion by sort of getting in a foot in the door, as it were, by portraying yourself as a pollster. And it's a reprehensible practice. It's condemned widely, but sadly, it probably still goes on a fair amount.
A tweet from Marfine: how do pollsters reach millennials and young people? We are notorious for not answering phone calls, especially robocalls. And is there a forecast on youth turnout for 2020? Andy, you work with young people.
Yes, they are very difficult to get on the telephone. That's one reason their costs have gone up so high over the last several years. But other people are having more difficult time reaching anybody. So that is one of the reasons that we, and I think Scott and other organizations, are using multiple methods of collecting data. As we said, we've been going to online surveys with probability-based samples to try to accomplish that. As far as a model for millennials, the rule of thumb, and this is their millennials aren't going to like to hear this, is that, frankly, young people don't vote. And if you're under 30 years old, you're going to vote at probably half the rate of your parents. So my rule of thumb, and this is like a sardonic view of the American political system, though, is if a candidate says they're going to win with the youth vote, they're going to lose. So older people come out and vote. That's why candidates go to senior centers and places like that, and why college kids are so usually say, well, if candidates aren't talking about issues that are important to me, I say, well, if you voted, they probably would.
Another tweet: given social media's reach and breadth to enlist followers to behave certain ways, how does modern polling account for deliberate lying in polls to skew results? For example, a group tells members, lie on all polls, which is happening right now in far left and right communities. Scott?
I've just not seen much evidence that the people that we poll, and as I mentioned, we have a particular method. We've recruited people to be regular participants in our polls. I've just not seen any evidence that that they are not telling the truth. Now, yes, I mean, we do know that people like to present a favorable view of themselves. That's one reason people say they're going to vote. Even if circumstances are going to pop up where they don't vote, where they're not motivated enough to push past those things. And we also find that people, sometimes if you ask them how they're doing financially, if they're really not doing well at all financially, they may be embarrassed and simply not answer that question as truthfully. But widespread lying, just telling you the opposite of what's true in order to sort of monkey with your poll, we just haven't seen much evidence. If that were going on, polling wouldn't have the very strong record that it has over 70 years of polling in elections, not only in the United States but around the world. I mean, the accuracy rates when you aggregate the polls are such that it just wouldn't be possible if there were widespread lying.
We'll go to Jason calling from Thomaston. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering if we will ever ask, or pollsters ask, the real impact of COVID-19 on people's voting behaviors, like including, will you go to the polls and vote, or are you voting absentee even though you've never done it before? Is there any way for us to get a handle on the impacts that are like right around the corner?
Interesting question. Dan?
Yes, as a matter of fact. We're going out in the poll with our next wave. Colby is doing a series of polls this election season. Our next wave will be, I think it's going to start, fingers crossed, on the 18th. And we do have a series of questions on COVID and the impact. It's really interesting, the difference between closed and open-ended questions. Pollsters will often use closed-ended questions where there's a fixed response set of fixed response categories because they're easy to code and they move along quickly. But if we had all the money in the world and all the time in the world, we'd ask a lot of open-ended questions. We'd simply ask voters to respond to a question in their own words. And Jason, I'd love to ask that. What's the relationship between the impact of this pandemic on your life and how you'll vote? And be a great, you get a lot of interesting information. The downside with open-ended questions is it's hard to code. It's hard to quantify. But at the same time, I think it's a great question, Jason. And we're going to do some of that.
Jason, thanks for that question. We'll move on to Bar Harbor and Anne. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. So I have been doing a lot of phone banking, as I had been in 2016. In 2016, at this time, I was dead certain that Trump was going to win because of negative information voters were volunteering. They weren't asking. I wasn't asking those questions, but people were so negative about Clinton. This year, the good news is I'm not hearing any negatives about Biden. I hear, you know, people slam the phone saying, I hate the Democrats, but not Biden. But the thing that I wanted to say about polls is, you know, I've read a lot of Jill Lepore's writing on polls, and I just feel like polls are wonderful if they motivate people to be more determined to vote, and that they're terrible if they lead to complacency. And I don't know how polling would work to find out why so many Americans don't vote at all, because that's the real problem. And I don't think either party is addressing that.
And thank you so much, because I did want to ask that question. I'll direct it to you, Scott. This idea of do polls themselves motivate people to vote or discourage people from voting?
Yes, unfortunately, I do think there is some truth to the idea that polls can demotivate people. You know, let me preface this just by saying that I am a huge supporter of polls. No surprise there, given the work that I've done for most of my life. But because I think that polls provide a way to represent the voices of people who otherwise wouldn't be represented other than on election day if they can, you know, if they can make it to the polls. But we did some experimental work after the 2016 election, and people who saw these forecasts that said that Hillary Clinton had a 95 or 99% chance of winning, that information caused them to be less likely to say that they would turn out. So we ran some experiments, not using the Hillary Clinton example, but something similar. And it does seem that people misunderstanding the certainty of the outcome can lead them, especially if they're sort of only marginally committed to voting, to decide it's not worth it, my vote isn't needed, and so forth. And so I hope that the aggregators will not make those mistakes again this year, and that pollsters will appropriately, you know, tell people that there's a lot of uncertainty associated with the work they do. I think that's doubly the case this year because of the question that one of your previous callers raised about the COVID situation. We just don't know whether people are going to vote the way they have in the past. We know that people say they're going to vote absentee at record numbers, and we don't know how well that's going to work.
Anne, thank you so much for that question. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about polling on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from MEMIC. With a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. The Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. And AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. AARP.org/MaineVotes.
Maine resident, writer, and illustrator Robert McCloskey was born on September 14, 1914. He wrote and also illustrated 9 picture books and won 2 Caldecott Medals from the American Library Association. 4 of his 9 illustrated books were set in Maine: Blueberries for Sal, One Morning in Maine, Time of Wonder, and Bert Dowd, Deepwater Man. His most notable book, Make Way for Ducklings, was set in Boston. Scott Island, Maine, where he and his wife and children spent summers, was the setting for Blueberries for Sal. He was named a living legend by the Library of Congress in 2000. McCloskey died in 2003.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, could wildfires in the West make you more vulnerable to coronavirus?
How and when exposure to wildfire smoke increases the likelihood of infection from COVID-19, we're still trying to figure that out, but there's a clear symmetry between exposure and the likelihood of infection.
Living with Fire on the next Climate One.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about the art and science of polling. My guests, Scott Keeter with the Pew Research Center, Andrew Smith with the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, and Daniel Shea with Colby College. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Bangor and Archie. Hi, Archie. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I don't know if it's a question, but I don't know how anyone could trust the network polls where they showed and demonstrated their hatred for President Trump. So I don't know how anybody could believe their polls because it's pretty obvious they'd like Biden to win.
Scott, I'm going to turn to you because I know you're involved in national polls.
Yes. I do understand the sentiment behind the question. There's a lot of polarized feeling about the national networks, and you know, true, but not only from people who support President Trump, but also people who are Democrats and liberals and their feelings about Fox News. Although it's interesting that Fox News has put out polls that have consistently shown Donald Trump behind, and I hear a lot of people saying they don't understand that, and of course President Trump himself has been critical of their polling, and I think the answer is fairly straightforward. The people who do the polling for the networks are professionals, all of whom belong to a professional association that I belong to, where our reputations are based upon the fairness and accuracy of what we do. And if you are biased against someone, number one, people can probably figure that out from the questions that you ask, if they're leading or misleading. And number two, you'll get the election wrong, and you'll have to own up and take responsibility for that. So the incentive structure in journalism for the professionals who conduct the polls align towards being honest and accurate as possible. So I think that's the simplest explanation for it.
Scott,
I agree.
Yeah, who's this?
This is Andy. This is
Go
Andy.
Ahead, Andy.
I agree. I've worked with CNN for many decades on the polling here in New Hampshire and with Fox News as well. And the professionals in both of those organizations, and this is many different professionals, have all been exactly that. They've been professionals. They want to do a good job. They want to make sure that their colleagues who scrutinize these things far more than the public does, they want to be sure that their colleagues have their respect. And I've never seen anybody in the polling industry try to shade the polls based on the editorial slant of their organization.
All right, Dan, do you want to add to that?
Well, I would add that maybe what Archie's focusing in on is the analysis of the polling results. And there is a degree of subjectivity. There could be a degree of bias. I'll give you one quick example. One of the first poll we did this year had Jared Golden at 43% and Dale Crafts at 15%. So the quick analysis that some people were saying is, wow, he's in really, really good shape. But I tried to slow people down and say, no, wait a second. The primary, the Republican primary, has just ended, right? This is an incumbent with less than 50%. You know, he's got a long ways to go to get over. You know, so the analysis of polling data is very important and can be subjective. So maybe that's what Archie's pointing towards.
All right. Thanks so much for your question, Archie. We will move to John, who's calling from Jefferson. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I want to put something on the table that hasn't been discussed. And this is what makes me absolutely furious at so many polls. They always concentrate, it seems like, on the two major parties. I've been a Green for 30 years, and a lot of times they don't even have even when they're qualified and are on the ballot, the pollsters do not put their name out, or they put other, which is insulting and degrading, when they put that out instead. So I wish they would always put the candidates, like here in the Senate race, this in Maine here for the U.S. Senate, there are four candidates, and for the most part, they seem to think it's only between Gideon and Collins. Well, Lisa Savage is the person I'm supporting as a Green, and we want to see her included in all the polls.
You know, let me jump on that, because he might even be referring to our poll. So the last poll that we did was immediately after the primary election, and we wanted to be quick with the poll after the primary election, because the Democrats had finally decided that Sarah Gideon would be the candidate. At that time, we didn't know who the minor party candidates would be. Tiffany Bond was caught in a legal issue, and Max Lynn was in and out. So we actually didn't have a full, complete list of the minor party candidates. So we asked that question saying, or will you support a minor party candidate? And 6% landed there. I understand what your caller is saying. We are moving with a rank choice question for our next poll. So Lisa Savage and Max Lynn will be listed. That's good.
All right.
That's a good point.
Yeah, John, thanks for your question. That's a really good one. It's interesting. I have questions on either side of this. So I'll start with Scott. Well, important. I have no time or interest in responding to polls. Is there not a do not poll directory I can get on, similar to the do not call directory? And then after you all answer that, there's somebody who wants to be a part of polls. So let's start. Does anybody know, is there a do not poll directory that people can sign up for? Any of you know that?
Well, there is all of the organizations that do polling that are responsible companies, and I assume that this is true for academic pollsters as well, although it's been a long time since I was one, will very quickly agree with the person who says, do not call me again. Here's my phone number. I don't want to ever hear from you again. And we will put them on an internal do not call list. And major research organizations definitely have that practice. But there is no federal do not poll list. Polling is exempted from some of the rules of the do not call list. And there's nothing that the federal government necessarily is doing to help you on this, but individual organizations definitely are. To the other question, that is, can you ask to be polled? Well, you can, but not by our organization. All the polling we do is where we recruit you in order to ensure that we get a representative sample. But there are a lot of online opt-in polls out there that you can join, like YouGov, for example, and there are many, many others.
Okay, we'll go to Bob, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Bob, go ahead.
Yes, hey, I was going to thanks for taking my call. I was going to respond to that there was no compelling evidence before the 2016 election as to why that poll went that way. I think it's not very compelling, but it's significant. In Maine, I'm a president of a large organization. We have meetings throughout the state of Maine, and there was at least 16 meetings, maybe 14 meetings, in which we got the debate going on this, even during the primaries, Republican primaries. And throughout that, we'd get a consensus of where people were coming from. And in an open discussion where people would say what they think, where other people could hear them, Trump had no support. I mean, there'd be like 35 and 40 people in the room. And he might have, and sometimes two or three people that would say that they were supporting him. That was when he was all throughout the primaries as well. When it came down to between Clinton
and Trump, then the same thing. We went to the same meeting. But what I would do at the end of each one of those meetings, after we had the discussions, I also had prepared a secret ballot vote. And in every instance, Trump won the secret ballot vote. And every instance, he lost miserably any open discussion of
So, Bob, this is related to this concept you were talking about before, the shy voter. And in your experience, you found that is the truth, that people, depending on how public they perceive their answer to be, are going to answer differently. But Dan, what we're talking about, right, are private polls where no one knows who is saying what.
Yeah, that's right. And there is what's called social desirability effect. So there are a number of places where, and it was, I think Andy mentioned earlier, there are places where it's difficult to get accurate information. But I agree with Scott. I'm not so sure the shy vote, the Bradley effect, was there in 2016. But, you know, there is another possibility we haven't talked about. Remember, polls are a snapshot in time, right? They capture the attitudes and opinions at a particular point in time. And many of the national polls ended by the weekend before the election. But remember, Jim Comey had come out with his press conference about, I think, 6 or 7 days before the election. So it's possible, to defend pollsters a little bit, it's possible that they had things, it was more accurate by the weekend than it was on election day. So it's important to remember that polling is a snapshot of time.
Bob, thanks for your question. I'm going to go to Susan in Brunswick. Susan, we're almost out of time, so if you could ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Sure. The early part of my career, I was a professional market researcher and market research analyst. I did audience survey and publications and periodicals research. And so I'm pretty familiar with the, you know, all of that. But I'm really concerned about how anyone thinks they can get a representative sample when so many of us will never answer a phone call unless we know the caller. There's just too much spam and scam out there for us to even pick up a call.
Sure. And Andy, I'll end with you. This is where you're talking about using science.
Well, you know, and I would refer to Scott. Scott's done a tremendous amount of research, and few organization has, but the long and short of it has, until recently, the samples that we were getting seemed to be pretty similar to those people who were most hardest to get a hold of. Scott, you could probably speak to some of your more recent stuff on that.
Well, I will just say I'm shocked as well that it's worked. If you'd asked me 20 years ago, would we still be getting representative samples at 5% response rates, 2% response rates, I'd say no way. Mm-hmm. But we are. And we don't really have a good understanding of why that is. But the people who do cooperate with us look very much like the people who don't.
Isn't that interesting? And that's the last word. Susan, thanks for your call. And that was Scott Keeter, a senior survey advisor with the Pew Research Center. Also with us, Dan Shea, professor and chair of the Department of Government at Colby College, and Andrew Smith, the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This program will be on again tonight at 7. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.